Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, produced in New England at WHUS Stores. TalkNation.org for news and discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Our guest today is Stephen Solds of Roslindale Neighbors for Peace and Justice. He describes himself as a psychoanalyst, clinical psychologist, and social activist. And while teaching at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, he also finds time to write and perform research duties on a web page he set up called Psychoanalysts for Peace and Justice, psychoanalystsopposewar.org. On May 1st, 2004, Stephen Solds wrote about the CBS 60 Minutes 2 publication of pictures of abuse and torture by U.S. soldiers at the Abu Ghraib detention facility in Iraq. 1 year later, April 5th, he's published another take on the prison abuse story titled The Psychodynamics of Occupation and the Abuse at Abu Ghraib. His articles often take a look at the responsibility factor, how Americans must play a role in preventing such abuses in the future. Both articles are available at zmag.org. Stephen Solds, welcome.
Thank you.
Let me ask you first about your initial reaction to learning of the abuse at Abu Ghraib prison and seeing the pictures. What were some of your first thoughts at hearing this story?
It was complex. On the one hand, since I'd followed war news very carefully, I was aware that something horrible was going on there. I mean, there were plenty of accounts in the alternative media, in the British press, etc., that of horrors in U.S. detention facilities. And, you know, Amnesty International had reported, so I'd seen all of this. On the other hand, we'd never known quite exactly what it was going on. I remember I wrote that the first piece was the Saturday after the CBS thing, and then I guess on Friday the Seymour Hersh article came out, because I wanted to document that this was not the work, could not be the work of a few bad apples, because it was known to anyone who wanted to know it, that the information had been publicly available, at least in the broad outlines, not the particular sexualized version of the thing, but that abuse had been occurring and had been occurring on a massive scale, was known to those who wanted to know it. So again, we have a so-called secret that's only a secret because people aren't either choose not to know, or the mainstream press chooses not to tell people. And then we get this shocked outrage that, you know, is things that are not, in fact, secret.
Just talk about your analysis of the dynamic between leaders, those following orders, and what happened to those prisoners.
Well, we have the leaders who has been well documented through memos and thousands of pages now for released documents that the ACLU and others have gotten, who after 9/11 and then after the Iraq War have authorized taking the gloves off and essentially brutality, who, you know, as we know, redefined torture so that no one on earth has ever been tortured, because if you're tortured, you're dead. Or I'm only slightly exaggerating, but that, you know, had to have significant organ failure for something to be torture. So why would you do that if it wasn't that things that used to be considered torture, that the U.S. regularly denounces as torture in its State Department reports on torture, for example, were now to be engaged in by the U.S. However, the way in governments like ours, things seem to work, is you don't actually issue orders. You create expectations, and then the famous plausible deniability of Iran-Contra, that the leaders don't actually tell you exactly what to do. They create expectations. So the soldiers in Iraq have been, in Abu Ghraib, were given the expectation that they were to be tough. General Miller of Guantanamo, Gitmo, visited and gave advice on how to Gitmoize the place, that the MPs were to set the conditions for interrogation by basically terrorizing the inmates. There was no limits were there, no training on human rights, not that such training necessarily works if there isn't a climate that communicates that human rights are actually important, but not even a pretense was made And MPs were praised for their efforts. A message was given out that Condoleezza Rice was personally very interested in what was going on there. The MPs try and do their job well, trying to be good soldiers. As we know from social psychological experiments, many people will cooperate with expectations of brutality, and that's what went on there. They tried very hard to do their job and became more and more creative. At the same time, however, I do suspect that there was an element of fun. They were in this horrible situation, terrified out of their minds, not only Iraq, but Abu Ghraib. There was radical understaffing. They had, somewhere, 6,000 to 10,000 inmates, almost no translators, couldn't even understand. For example, there had been a major riot, and as the Washington Post documented, this riot was about maggots in the food and the poor and awful food there, and no one knew what it was about. They thought it was an escape attempt because no one could speak Arabic. So you've got thousands and thousands of people you're controlling. You can't communicate with them. Now, natural processes of dehumanization occur. I mean, we know from reporters who've been with U.S. troops and have carefully documented that troops routinely refer to Iraqis as Hajis, a term of derogation, not unlike those we have in this country for black people and others, and that Iraqis are considered to be stupid and obstinate and all those things that dominated people are usually considered to be. And then you've got thousands of Iraqis in a prison who can't be understood. The guards are terrified, and they get into processes of further dehumanization. At the same time, loosening some of the more unpleasant tendencies that people can have in such circumstances. So what I was trying to think about, I mean, I'm firmly convinced that the broad outlines of what happened were desired by the policymakers. We know from documentation that military intelligence was involved, though it's never been studied systematically. And yet I'm sure that Granger and some of the others were also having fun. I mean, many of us, when we have a job to do, an unpleasant job, find some way to make it fun. And they did that. But that's not the main part of the story. The main part of the story is that circumstances were created where that was the expected result because it was desired that that would happen. So that's the main analysis.
So many of the prisoners that were studied by Human Rights Watch and other organizations were determined to be innocent. And I just...
They're between 70 and 90%, Amnesty has reported.
So really we're talking about thousands of Iraqis, and one would have to claim that as a failed policy, right?
Well, depends on what the policy is. And that's where... Was the policy, as they claimed, really intelligence gathering, in which, of course, people who have no intelligence aren't going to give you anything? Or is the policy to terrorize the Iraqi population? And I'm not so sure. I do believe that the attack on Fallujah this November was to send a message that we will, if you oppose us, we will destroy you. So it may very well be that the intention, at least at some level, is to terrorize the population, in which case it's not necessarily a failed policy.
It's more intimidation.
Well, I don't know, but I'm saying that we can't rule that out. We don't have the evidence of the thinking, and as a psychoanalyst, we know that there's often unconscious wishes as well as conscious ones.
Mm-hmm. 1 year after the major reports about torture at Abu Ghraib, we're really seeing the shine come off of the boots of the U.S. military in many ways, where you have commanders who were given $6 million to provide reconstruction in various parts of Iraq. And some 80% of it is missing, according to a June 29, 2005 story in Interpress News by William Fisher. And then $7 billion is known to be missing from the new Oil for Food project. And this is run by America, and it's called the Development Fund for Iraq, the Coalition Provisional Authority was giving U.S. representatives money, and they were handing it out. And most of it, much of it, seems to be missing. And there are hearings going on right now about that. We have the PLAME investigation. It's breaking open right now with implications about Karl Rove. And so it seems more and more people are challenging the White House, and the president and White House are coming under criticism. So is the war and occupation of Iraq. Do you think that this is going to divide us further or possibly bring us together in a kind of common outrage?
I mean, such things always unite and divide. I mean, there's a segment of the population who's been outraged for quite a while at what's going on there. The Zogby poll at the end of last week, I believe it came out on Friday, found that 42% of the population supported impeachment if Bush was found to lie. On the other hand, there's a 30 to 40% of the population who will support my country right or wrong, to use an old Cold War and Vietnam era phrase. You know, the country is never fully united except in moments of crisis, when unfortunately it's often united around unfortunate things, as occurred after 9/11, where this ill-named war on terrorism got launched, and we were all in shock. I don't think opposition to government policy ever unites the whole country. I mean, Watergate left a bitter core of people, many of whom are now in power, who felt that Nixon and was betrayed. You know, no matter what happens, we'll have that faction. But it does seem that there is a shift in the populace.
I want to go back to talking about the prison, Abu Ghraib. And there are lots of investigations going on right now, more documentation being released. And so we expect to hear quite a bit about the conclusions on whether or not this was an intelligence policy, a phenomenon that took place at all of the containment facilities run by America. But you say that the nature of prisons is such that the inmates are presumed guilty by the guards. And then if they don't cooperate, you know, provide information, go along, then they're just discounted more or less as human beings. And it's only those who collaborate, some might say, in Iraq, that are treated more easily. So just talk about this idea of, you know, guilt versus innocence and the law.
Holding people in prisons is not a pleasant business. Most of us put in that position as guards can't do it unless we assume that the people who are there are bad. People form rationalizations, and one of them is they must have done something wrong. There must be a reason why they're here. So I'm presuming that was part of what went on. It happens in U.S. prisons. It happens in most prisons in the world. Why wouldn't it happen there, especially where you have ill-trained guards who are thrown into this position who, you know, don't know how to run a prison? That's not what they've been trained to do. They're either trained to fight wars or, in the case of National Guard, largely trained to put out forest fires and help in emergencies. And all of a sudden, they're guarding these thousands of people who, remind you, they could not talk with. They couldn't even understand. So they had to believe that they were guilty of something. That's how people work.
So we have U.S. military guarding thousands of Iraqis and arresting them in the middle of the night, dragging them off with rubber hoods over their heads and shackles. And it just all seems retaliatory. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, we know that since 9/11, there's been this climate of retaliation in the country. We have to get back at somebody. And the Bush administration very cleverly channeled that toward Iraq, even though, you know, they knew full well, and everyone knows full well, Iraq had nothing whatsoever to do with it. But most people in the U.S. don't make great distinctions. I mean, after all, who could locate Iraq on a map? Who knows where Afghanistan is? You know, these all merge together. They're them. They attacked us, people say over and over again. I get nasty emails all the time about they attacked us. You know, and there's no, you know, distinctions aren't made. We formed this in-group, this us, and the out-group, them. And people don't do a lot of distinguishing among who they are. So we've had this general climate of retaliation. We know that when the Saddam statue was toppled in after the brief war in Baghdad, that supposedly a flag that had flown, I believe, over the Pentagon, if I recall correctly, was put up briefly, an American flag, until the military propaganda people realized that that was not going to be a very good image, since it was supposed to be the Iraqis who were downing the statue, and it was taken down. Revenge, the soldiers report that they were told by their officers that we're going to get revenge, we're going to kill Arabs for what they did to us. So then you have troops there in this dual role. On the one hand, they're told we're liberators, we're freeing these people from tyranny. On the other hand, they're told we're getting revenge. That's a very complex psychological thing to ask people to hold, especially at a time when they're under attack. They're, fearing for their lives on a daily basis. The insurgency is growing. The conditions are just horrible. I mean, the American soldiers didn't even have enough water to drink in the Iraqi heat. So to expect this subtlety, it's not plausible, and there was obviously no effort made. For example, the U.S. has made no effort to train troops to speak Arabic. In World War II, they had thousands and thousands of cards with basic words in Japanese or in German. They had crash training courses. They have not done this. They obviously don't think that communicating with Iraqis is of any importance, because they've made absolutely no attempt to help U.S. troops be able to do so. Even to know what the word stop is at these checkpoints. So the basic message is that they don't matter. We have the Lancet report that survey, based on an excellent survey, estimating that 100,000 Iraqis had been killed largely by U.S. bombing. That would have been as of last September. So my guess is the estimates were a little high there, but they're probably considerably higher at this point, as it's almost a year later than that work. So we have massive killing of Iraqis, which communicates they're not important. And in fact, the official U.S. ideology is force protection. Basically, it doesn't matter how many Iraqis die if it's necessary to protect U.S. forces. You can do whatever is necessary. One American life is worth any number of Iraqi lives. So that also communicates that they don't matter. So you have they being blamed for this horrible attack on America, and then all the circumstances communicate that they don't matter, that they're not really important. In other words, they're not really people.
Now, it seems an 8-year-old could see through that kind of an argument, and in most cases, we do see that the Bush administration's policies, as described by the president and others, Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, Vice President, Karl Rove, they put things in such very simplistic terms. You know, the policy is attacked, and so there's this knee-jerk reaction to attack the person who's providing the criticism and tear their arguments apart rather than address the questions. And, you know, this seems to have been gotten away with over the last few years, so they're pursuing it still. But it's in the face of so much more knowledge and information. And one has to sort of ask, at what point do the American people, members of the armed forces and others, take into consideration sort of the ridiculous factor? I mean, it begs the question of how much can the American people buy?
In some sense, I think the problem at this point is less how much people will buy than how much people really care. The polls seem to show increasingly that people see through this, at least a large percentage of people see through it. 59 or something percent in some of the polls think the war was a mistake. Some people, large numbers, say that it's making America less safe, et cetera. But I think the bigger problem is the administration is very good at changing the story. So the attack, when Newsweek reports about throwing of Korans in the toilet, they turn it to they attack Newsweek and their news gathering, just changing the whole story to some issue about what kind of checking did they do, and ignoring the truth, the basic truth of the story, which is that the Koran was abused, and in fact, we now have credible reports from many people that it was indeed thrown in the toilet, but that comes out later, and the story instead becomes Newsweek, and they have used this over and over again, and it works, so I don't see why they wouldn't use it, but I don't think, it's not so much that it's tricking people, is it? It conveys, I think, a sense that things are complicated, and is it really worth paying, I'd rather read the sports page, or see what's the latest in the Michael Jackson trial, or I don't know what trial's on now that Jackson was acquitted a week ago, so... the issue is more what people really care about. In the absence of a draft, many people, you know, they feel the war's not great, it's not going well, so they may even think it's wrong, but it doesn't motivate them on a daily basis, because it doesn't affect them on a daily basis unless they happen to be one of the unfortunate families who have a family member over there. And then you've got this dual loyalty. Are you being disloyal to your family member by questioning, which has always been difficult. So I think the question is more how much, what would get people to burn with passion about the war? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, that's clearly one of the major reasons that they're avoiding the draft, is that they're afraid that the draft would change that equation tremendously, because the war then could affect each of us. Many of us.
Now, in your article, The Psychodynamics of Occupation and the Abuse at Abu Ghraib, you talk about the pressure that was building to generate actionable intelligence from the prisoners and General Miller visiting. And you talk about the prison's then eventual sort of dedication to the gathering of intelligence and use of brutal torture techniques that had been developed at Guantanamo. You go on to say, and I want to quote you here, the effort to generate intelligence out of the prisoners was especially difficult, as according to military intelligence sources, perhaps 70 to 90% of them were innocent of any involvement with the insurgents and just happened to be present at a checkpoint or in their home when one of the brutal cordon and capture raids occurred. Nonetheless, the response of top military leaders to their innocence was callous at best. Major General Walter Wojciechowski is quoted as telling Brigadier General Janis Karpinski, the officer in charge of Iraqi prisons, "I don't care if we're holding 15,000 innocent civilians. We're winning the war." While the officer in charge of U.S. forces in Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, retorted, "Why are we detaining these people? We should be killing them." Just talk about that kind of comment by a leading representative of the U.S. military.
Well, militaries are created to fight. They're basically killing machines. And in this case, where they're fighting an enemy that they don't know how to fight, they hadn't planned on fighting an aroused nationalist populace who didn't want an occupation, in those circumstances, admitting defeat is not an option, as they say. So you do whatever it takes to win. And if destroying the enemy is necessary and the enemy is the populace of the country, well, that's what you do.
Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez actually was promoted even after revelations about Abu Ghraib and the fact that, you know, he ran this operation. Why don't you talk a little bit about this whole idea of impunity?
Well, I mean, we've had it over and over again. Most of the people responsible for Abu Ghraib and for Guantanamo have been promoted. You know, some of them sit on the federal bench. We have the Attorney General of the United States, who may be appointed to the Supreme Court, is a man who wrote memos justifying torture. And then, you know, he headed a work group to develop the U.S. policy toward torture, and then claims he doesn't remember any of the discussion there. The administration has this to a fine art. It's such a classic counter of the right-wing ideology of personal responsibility that President Bush and conservatives like to talk about. But personal responsibility, of course, is always for for others, the lazy louts, the poor people, working people, because this administration has no responsibility. I mean, they've all been promoted. General Sean Sanchez has been promoted. And I think part of it, like, my personal guess is that Sanchez doesn't really matter, but it's more, what would he tell if he were unhappy? And what might other people tell? And and I also think there's an arrogance that President Bush, I suspect, enjoys kind of sticking it to people and sort of saying, I can get away with this. That's my explanation for the Bolton nomination. Why appoint this guy who, had personally had this visceral hatred of the United Nations to be UN ambassador? I think it was to say, look, I can do this. I can put this guy, who everyone knows is inappropriate, I can get him in there. Now, they may have failed on that one. Still remains to be seen. But I think there's an arrogant quality, and that some of these promotions may also have that kind of arrogance of sticking it to those human rights wimps or whatever they think of. Because I think that's been a large part of this business. I think Guantanamo is not about fighting terrorism. It's not about fighting al-Qaeda. I mean, all the accounts are that they've got no intelligence out of it, that at least a number of the people there are innocent. We don't really know. And there's no reason why using legal process couldn't have been used in any case. But it's about showing that they can do it. It's about showing that there are no limits on them. And I think that's a large part of it. So giving a promotion to Sanchez is also showing that it doesn't matter. What you people think doesn't matter. We can do this. And I think that's a large part of the psychology, which, on the other hand, may set them up for a fall. History is full of arrogant leaders who, if one reads Shakespeare, who don't, in the end, do so well. And that may be the real weakness of the administration, because they are geniuses at manipulation, but they seem to be addicted to continuing to do it.
And so do you see this wall that they've built around themselves to insulate themselves as getting higher or perhaps starting to crack?
Well, I think it's clearly starting to crack in the popular perception, but, it remains to be seen how it's going to play out. I mean, certainly with the Supreme Court nominations, they get the opportunity potentially to solidify their control of the federal judiciary, which will last for many decades. And I think part of what they've been up to is being concerned that they may not have power forever and trying for a maximalist agenda, sort of all or nothing while they have it. They certainly have changed the nature of political discourse in this country to such a degree that, the Democrats have been afraid to take them on. There's been very little opposition. For example, in the Iraq War, virtually none of the mainstream politicians has anything to say other than, oh, you don't have a plan, you haven't carried it out well. But there's almost no one in major discourse who will say the war was wrong to begin with, not that it was ill-planned or, badly conducted, but that invading another country that didn't pose a threat is wrong. That's not part of political discourse in this country. Just as during Vietnam, there were very few people saying the Vietnam War was wrong, very few people in the leadership positions. So with no alternative position being espoused, it's not clear what's going to happen. You've got a falling of the wall, but you've got no alternative being proposed in any systematic way. And so I don't know how it's going to play out.
Stephen Solds teaches at Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis. You will find Psychoanalysts for Peace and Justice online at psychoanalystsopposewar.org. You've been listening to Talk Nation Radio. For a transcript of this program and a discussion about its content, log on to talknation.org. I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of WHUS Stores, radio for the people at the University of Connecticut.